Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from September 5th, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is the second of two talks on the Asatthava Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches dependent origination in relation to the five clinging aggregates and the difficulty in clinging to mental fabrications. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So tonight's sutta is the second on the Asatthava Sutta. This is another sutta where the Buddha teaches dependent origination, but he uses it in the context that it's easier to recognize and abandon clinging to the physical form, to our body, as it is to letting go of clinging to our conditioned thoughts. And it really is because it's our conditioned way of looking at the world that defines who we are in our experience. So, of course, it's much more difficult. We can recognize the difficulties of a human body. It gets sick at times, it ages. Happy birthday. And eventually it's going to die. And along the way, it is mostly through the body that we have experiences of suffering, but only because we don't recognize that where that suffering is really occurring is between our ears. It's the way we're looking at ourselves in relation to the world. So I'm just going to go back just a paragraph or two from what we read last week. The Buddha's words on this, on dependent origination and how important it is to understand it. The well-instructed follower of the Dhamma attends mindfully and appropriately to dependent origination. I mean, we have to develop an understanding of it. It doesn't have to be instantaneous. And the first line that the Buddha uses as an introduction to dependent origination is, when this is, that is. And that one line has been taken way out of context to say that to take dependent origination and apply it in ways it was never meant to be applied. Then the Buddha teaches dependent origination by saying, in other words, from ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrications. In other words, from this ignorance comes mental fabrications. Mental fabrications, the best description or easiest description is mental fabrications are assumptions we've made about ourselves in relation to the world around us, rooted in ignorance. And that last part is the most important part. Because if those assumptions are rooted in ignorance, what we're seeing and what we're experiencing and what we're categorizing in the outside world is rooted in an ignorant view. So the Buddha's not saying that we are simply just ignorant people because we're human beings. It is a very specific ignorance. It's ignorance of Four Noble Truths, which is what he taught for his entire teaching career. So I know I went over this at the end of last week, but just to get us back into it. From those fabrications, from those assumptions, as a requisite condition comes consciousness. Notice that this is not some grand type of cosmic consciousness the Buddha's talking about that is interconnected with all things. It's consciousness rooted in ignorance. So even if it is, and this is something I don't go this far. Even if we can extrapolate our consciousness as interconnected with all other consciousness is, all those consciousnesses are rooted in that ignorance. So there's no real value in maintaining that clinging view that we're all one grand consciousness, is there? Because it's rooted in ignorance. We have to start separating that interdependence and interconnectedness and this idea of interbeing. If we're going to awaken, we need to learn how to see things discreetly, and that if our views are rooted in ignorance, everything that follows will be this way.
Ignorance of the Four Noble Truths.
Ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. Yeah, we're not ignorant of how to live in the world. We all can live, we can start our car or whatever we have to do. We're not ignorant as human beings. We're ignorant of the cause of our confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing unsatisfactory experiences, which is the only thing the Buddha was concerned about. But it's because of that we create very distracted minds. And nearly everyone I talk to, the main reason why they start coming to a meditation class is because they can't quiet their minds. They talk about this monkey mind. I know I certainly had it, and I think all of us have mentioned that at one time or another. And it's because of not understanding our relationship with the world, a right view, that we lose control of our mind. It keeps going and going and going, churning these assumptions to maintain the ignorance. Good evening. Please come in.
Thank you.
From that consciousness, as a requisite condition, comes name and form. The Pali word for name and form is namarupa. It's simply identifying ourselves, giving a name to this form. This is me, this is John, and this is who I am, this is who I'm going to be. From that identification, from name and form, as a requisite condition, comes the sixth sense base. The sixth sense base is our five physical senses, and then that sixth sense of consciousness rooted in ignorance. Now remember, the Buddha is describing a process that begins in ignorance. From that sixth sense base, as a requisite condition, comes contact. I have to have, now that I've identified myself as this physical form, there has to be some vehicle for me to come in contact with the outside world. That's my senses. If none of us had senses, we'd just be a blob. And none of this would have any meaning at all, because there wouldn't be any self-referential view, but there also wouldn't be any opportunity for awakening. From the sixth sense base, as a requisite condition, comes contact. From contact, as a requisite condition, comes feeling. So obviously something has to occur to me for me to have a feeling. And in this sense, it's not just a physical feeling. It's any movement or disturbance in the mind. And that disturbance in the mind could be excitement or supposed happiness. Any movement in the mind is a feeling in this sense. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. So something has occurred to me. I've decided I like it or don't like it. That sets this craving compulsion. And once that's established, the self is established, a self-referential view, because that self has said, I like this, I don't like that. We've created, this is where it leads to conditioned thinking, we've created conditions in our life that we like to think we have control over that we don't, and we make those conditions the condition for how we're going to experience our life. Is that clear? It's at this step in dependent origination where a conditioned mind starts becoming manifest. It's rooted in assumptions beginning in ignorance.
Could you do that again slowly?
I don't know. I'll try. and think about restraint, too, as I'm talking about this. Mm-hmm. It's at that point of movement in the mind, a feeling arises from contact. I start deciding, I like this, and it might just begin becoming initially enamored with me, meaning the beginning of conceit. But any time that we decide, I need this for my happiness, or I need to avoid this for my complete satisfaction and my ongoing happiness, we're creating conditions in our life, aren't we? I'll go back to the old chocolate cake. Unless I get at least one slice of chocolate cake every day, I'm not going to be happy. That's a condition that I'm placing on the world that is completely ignorant, because there's likely going to be a day coming along right around pretty quickly that I won't have chocolate cake. But because I've decided that I need chocolate cake to be happy, there's a condition on my life that's part of conditioning my mind. Is that clear? And so, from that point, you can see anything that we decide as a condition for our happiness is conditioning our mind. And if it's at this point that we engage in an understanding of dependent origination and practice restraint in this process, we start deconditioning our mind. Is that clear?
That's fascinating.
And this is, yeah, it is, isn't it? Because this is exactly how it works. And I don't want to overemphasize the links in the chain of dependent origination, because we can really get confused about, okay, where am I? It's enough to recognize, practice restraint at the sixth sense base, and we can start undoing our conditioned thinking.
And it's not about don't like chocolate cake. It's about don't depend on liking chocolate cake.
To make
yes.
Happy.
It means when we have chocolate cake, enjoy it as thoroughly as it's appropriate.
And then the next moment comes
yep.
You're okay if the cake
don't
is gone.
Yep, and if the next moment happens to bring great sadness, we feel a great sadness when it's appropriate. Rather than, you know, the reason why we get so upset when we're sad is we're conditioned to think there's something wrong with feeling that way. Mike was talking about that a little bit, and I might be going a little further than you meant to with that on Saturday. But we're kind of trained, especially men, but it's really falling on women now, that we're not supposed to get upset at anything. We're not supposed to feel fear or sadness. And that's an aspect of conditioning, isn't it? When it's appropriate to feel sadness, somebody asked, I think it was the first retreat, I think it was during dependent origination, and he took this a little too far. He says, what happens, meaning that there's no such thing as a self, is where he was taking this. And he says, well, what happens if you're on the train tracks and a train is coming at you? Meaning, do you just stand there? No. You take two steps to the right or to the left. It doesn't mean that we don't live in the world in a realistic way. It means that we live in the world in an entirely meaningful and realistic way. We feel what's appropriate to feel without attaching any self-referential view to it. And it is fascinating. This is how we start undoing the 12 causative links that eventually lead to ongoing confusion, delusion, and suffering. I can see you have a question more.
Well, we'll comment. I'll make it brief. You know, the way that also I look at it is, it's even on, you know, obviously it's on a more subtle level than just chocolate cake, because we all know that we could, like, avoid chocolate cake and be okay or something, or not. I mean, so, but from anything, because the six sense bases are sound, touch, you know, sight, so we start to move, develop this sense that moves after all kinds of experiences and all other kinds of experiences we move away from. And that begins to move the trajectory of our life.
Yep. Ruled by what we are attracted to or what we hope to avoid.
And you know, from all emotional sounds,
yep.
This is too loud, that's too soft, I don't want to be around
that's
this, it has to be quiet, it has to be...
That initiating feeling is any type of disturbance in the mind. And the reason why I say that, and Moore is bringing some great clarification, it could be anything. You know, it's not just
and
chocolate
cake. It's moment by moment by moment by moment by moment.
Yeah. And when we free ourselves from that, then we live our lives, our life, moment by moment as it occurs, rather than needing what's occurring to be any different than it is.
But isn't there also a difference between a feeling, which is, maybe a normal reaction, you know, sadness or whatever, we make it complicated is when a feeling attaches to a thought, you know, like we might start defending something because I feel this way. This is my point of view. How dare you challenge my point of view? And I'm allowed to think what I want or, you know, any of those things. Those aren't feelings anymore. Those are like something.
No,
yes.
The initial feeling started that whole chain going.
Right.
I once had a teacher, his name was Arnold Patton. He taught something similar to Buddhism, but he called him Universal Principle. He was a great guy, but in the end it didn't all add up. But he used to say this great teaching. His whole teaching, you could boil it down to, if you can just feel joy in every minute, everything's going to be wonderful. And of course, the reason why we ultimately can't feel joy in every minute is because we're not seeing in right view. But he taught something that was really important about emotion. An emotion is a thought attached to a feeling. Or a judgment attached to that feeling. And that's the point. It's that judgment, meaning this feeling is good, bad, or even indifferent. You know, that kind of a way of removing ourselves from a situation because it doesn't stimulate us enough is still part of craving and clinging. It's at that point that we're creating. It's at that point of contact that we're conditioning our mind. And so if we can practice restraint at that point of contact, we can start undoing these links of dependent origination. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. And that points to what we are going to become in this moment. If what we're reacting to is rooted in ignorance, we can only become more ignorant. If we are developing a Dhamma and we can start interrupting this process, we can start becoming awakened. Right? Hence the name of the new book, by the way. From becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. From birth as the requisite condition comes sickness, aging, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, despair. Such is the origination of the entire mass of confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. And I know we touched on this a little bit last week. And our talks on Saturday have been on karma and rebirth, so those talks are getting more into this. But we're not just talking about a physical birth in the future. In fact, what's most important, and it points to this sutta, what's going on in our mind is what we're giving birth to in each moment. A future life really doesn't have any consequence to what's occurring right now. In fact, we can eliminate that possibility if we would just take to the Dhamma and awaken. And future births take care of themselves. So now the Buddha gets into how to undo this. The Buddha's words, now from the complete cessation of ignorance of Four Noble Truths comes a cessation of fabrication. Right back to when this isn't, that isn't. When ignorance is no more, there's no more fabrications. There's no more assumptions about the world. We're simply seeing things clearly. And just because Margaret's new and we have a few new people, this is the reason why we use meditation for deepening concentration. Because we have to have a well-concentrated mind in order to hold in mind these principles that are occurring in our life and see them clearly. That's really the sole reason for meditation, even though there's great benefits beyond just a well-concentrated mind. But a well-concentrated mind can see this process as it's occurring, and rather than reacting to it, it can integrate the Eightfold Path into our lives and stop the process. When this isn't, that isn't. From the cessation of fabrications comes the cessation of consciousness. Remember, consciousness rooted in ignorance. If we can find a way through the Eightfold Path to stop that process of assumptions requiring ignorance and ending that ignorance, nothing else can follow, can it? The ongoing conditioned consciousness cannot follow. None of these steps can follow. From the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form, identifying yourself as this physical body and nothing else. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of the sixth sense base. And of course, the Buddha, remember, you got to keep this in context, because some people will say, well, what happens when you let go of your senses? He's not saying that as you awaken, you lose the ability to see or touch or taste or smell. You're losing the connection between your sixth sense base and supporting those assumptions rooted in ignorance. The cessation of that process is what the Buddha is talking about. So now, as we become awakened and something comes through our sense gates, the sixth sense base, we are using that to interpret reality rather than to interpret ignorance. In fact, I probably shouldn't use the word interpret reality. We're using our senses to see reality clearly rather than continue to interpret ignorance. Clear? From the cessation of the sixth sense base comes the cessation of contact. There's simply no consequence now because there's nothing rooted in ignorance. So contact with the world is just an ongoing, like Maura was saying, it's just an ongoing experience of life as life occurs. From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of feeling. And again, remember, feeling in this way of looking at it is simply a disturbance in the mind. So now a feeling is no longer a disturbance in the mind. It's simply an appropriate way of being engaged in the world. From the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of craving. Since that feeling is not rooted in ignorance, no craving arises. We might have the greatest piece of chocolate cake we ever had. Doesn't matter, we just enjoy it and move on. We may have the most sublime and meaningful experience that we've ever had, and we don't seek to recreate it, but we're able to be mindful of what's occurring. When I think about something like that, I think about the great sunsets in Hawaii. Those are things that are just magnificent, but they're fleeting. There's nothing to hold on to there. From the cessation of craving comes the cessation of clinging and maintaining. You see how the process now, we're undoing the maintaining of a self-referential ego self? Is that part clear? We're unraveling the 12 links of dependent origination. And at any point, once any one of these links is completely broken, the whole thing falls apart. From the cessation of clinging and maintaining comes the cessation of becoming more ignorant. From the cessation of becoming more ignorant comes the cessation of giving birth. Let me read it the way that the Buddha said it first. From the cessation of becoming comes the cessation of birth. From the cessation of becoming more ignorant comes the cessation of giving birth to another ignorant moment. And this is where a lot of the misunderstanding of even dependent origination comes on. Because there's no qualifier for becoming in the way the Buddha presents it, in the way that it was recounted by the monks after his death. But of course, they all understood the Buddha's frame of reference in the context. And if you take that idea of becoming right back to the beginning of this, we're talking about becoming more ignorant or becoming awakened. From the cessation of birth comes the cessation of sickness, aging, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. From the cessation of birth comes the cessation of the entire mass of confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. From the cessation of giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance We cease creating suffering in our own lives. Now, of course, it doesn't mean that we won't continue to have sickness, we won't continue to age, we won't have a physical death, but we will no longer react to it, we won't be preoccupied with it. When it occurs, it'll simply be what's occurring. When something comes up that causes regret, it's appropriate to feel that in the moment, if it is. And it'll simply be something that we feel. We won't need it to be any different than it is. Our minds will remain at peace and calm. The Buddha continues, understanding this clearly and within the proper context, the well-instructed disciple of the Dhamma grows disenchanted with form, disenchanted with feelings, disenchanted with perception, disenchanted. Now that we're getting into the five clinging aggregates. Pay attention. Disenchanted with perception, disenchanted with fabrications, disenchanted with consciousness. Now, what disenchanted with this whole process that we've used to maintain ignorance. It doesn't mean we're disenchanted with our life as our life unfolds. We're simply disenchanted with the things that we've conditioned ourselves to believe are necessary to be happy.
John, can you give another word for disenchanted?
Disenchanted?
Disenchanted.
It's a pretty good word.
That's a good distinction. It doesn't mean disenchanted necessarily with the world, but you said disenchanted with the process in which becoming...
I don't know if I can give a better word than disenchanted.
It's not really no longer attached to it. It's no longer in its
throne. No, I'm trying to think. Disenamored, you know...
So maybe we're no longer...
Here's the reason why it works, though. Because it's enchanted with the things of the world that we maintain craving and clinging.
But you just said it's disenchantment with the process from which all the dependent origination,
yes.
All those links.
Yep.
So we see that process. Well, maybe we see pieces of
that process.
And then we realize that, oh my gosh, like this is really, this only results in suffering. So I'm going to, when I can, either clinging, craving, or sometimes, maintaining that or something. So we're disenchanted, but there's something.
Well, I'm going to stick with disenchanted. Sorry. Yeah. I just think it's the best description.
That's fine. It is the best description. Sometimes it helps me to hear a few other similar terms that mean the same thing. And there are such things in the...
Yeah, part of the word enchantment is the fact that it blinds you.
Mm.
Yeah, that's another good word to use for ignorance. An aspect of ignorance is we create these conditions, these strategies, these scenarios to ignore our own ignorance. Mm-hmm. It masks it. And it's because it's so strong, because we are so enchanted.
Intoxicated.
Oh, okay, so disintoxicated. Disintoxicated with form, disintoxicated with feeling. Oh, okay. So it means that we're going from an extreme wrong view. Remember, the Eightfold Path is the middle way between extreme views. An extreme view is this extreme clinging that we do to the things that we've created to make an identity of ourselves. I like this, I don't like that. Liz?
And sometimes you're so... your mind is just so integrated with that way of doing it that you don't even realize that you're clinging to that you're I think I was listening to this recording while I was walking tonight, and I felt like it was the first time I really heard that if it's that what you think will make you happy is not what makes you happy.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And yeah.
Of course, everything folds back into the Four Noble Truths, and then that's where, I say this all the time, but the way everything just folds back on itself over and over and over again is the way that learning can really take place, because if you go over here, it happens in a certain way, and then it folds back into over here, and then if you use use restraint and stop the cycle of the five clinging aggregates, then it almost like it's almost like you feel after a while you're building momentum because that's that and this is this, and you know, anyway, I just hearing it tonight on the recording.
She probably heard that same line, John, that I tried to tell you about at dinner the other night. Because that's exactly where it was. You said it slightly different. And I was like, oh, that's really good. I get it.
Good. Thank you. So, now I lost what I was going to say.
Well, no, it's just what you think. You think that extra piece of cake is going to make you happy. You think that, you know...
Right.
You think all things.
Evaluate all the things that you think are going to make you happy.
Yep.
And really evaluate them according to the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and the results that you're hoping for by going through this whole process.
Yes, that's what Kandana understood when he declared. Kandana heard the Buddha's first teaching, and he at the end of that teaching he awakened. He saw things clearly, and he declared that all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. And on the surface, that sounds kind of obvious and not all too important for the Buddha to say, you are now an awakened human being, except he understood that Kandana saw that all conditioned things that we attach ourselves to, create a condition for our own happiness, are all impermanent. They're all subject to cessation. They can never provide lasting satisfaction, simply because of the inherent impermanence of all things. And we're getting into the a teaching on the three marks of existence, but you really can't take that out because of how all this is weaving, wove together. But I won't get into that. But if you just think about that on a surface level, but not so much this silly analogy with the chocolate cake, but think about our attachments to our own conditioned views. And unless the world continues to fit itself into my view, I'm not going to be happy. And of course, we're never happy because of that. And that doesn't mean we don't have days of feeling wonderful in life. There's aspects of life that are great. But this underlying tension is always there because we're always trying to fit our views in a way that it can't fit. They just don't work.
We're always trying to make something happy that doesn't really exist anyway.
Well, again, and even if we have the most wonderful sunset or the biggest piece of chocolate cake or the most wonderful relationship or anything else that we can say is part of life, if we're attached to it in a self-referential way, it's prone to make us unhappy. It's prone to be disappointing. If we let go of the... If every one of us awakened in this moment, left here and went home, nobody could tell, except by the way we carry ourselves. You couldn't tell from outside appearances. You couldn't tell by the way we looked. Nothing would change except the way we relate to that. Our lives would be exactly the same unless we decide to change them. You can't tell. The only way you can tell, this is why when you start looking at how other people are, these people look like they're so this and that. I don't want to get into that. The only way you can tell if you're awakened is to awaken. You can't tell it through looking at the world in relation to wrong views. You have to recognize all wrong views and let go of them, and then you will be an awakened or a fully mature human being. And think about what the word maturity means. It simply means a mature human being accepts what's going on, right? We don't think it has to be any different. But on a very profound level, with life as life occurs. Everybody's good there? Okay, let me continue with this. So disenchanted with form, disenchanted with feelings, disenchanted with perceptions, disenchanted with fabrications, disenchanted with consciousness. We simply become disenchanted. We're no longer in love with the things that we've used to describe ourselves to the world or used to describe to make a self. I'm making. This is me. I like this. I like that. This is what I want out of my life. This is what I expect. This is what I need to avoid. This is what I hope the world develops towards. All that stuff is all I'm making. We become disenchanted with that process. We're no longer enamored with this I'm making. Disenchanted, they become dispassionate. And that doesn't mean we don't have passion for life. It means we don't have passion for continuing ignorance. Through this passion, they are fully released from the five clinging aggregates. Excuse me. With complete release, they know they're fully released. You know that you're awakened. How do you know you're awakened? You know you're awakened. You know it. Nobody else can describe it to you. You know that your mind is no longer agitated by the smallest things or the greatest things. You know that you're fully released. Released from what? Released from what follows from ignorance. They know that giving birth to additional views rooted in ignorance has ended. They know that a life well integrated within the Eightfold Path has been fulfilled. And this is an interesting line. Following, they've developed the Eightfold Path and they know the task is done. There's nothing else to do. They know that clinging to the world has ended. That's the end of the sutta. They know that clinging to the world has ended. You know it. It's not something you guess. It's not something you need somebody else to tell you. It's not something that can be transmitted. It's not something that be bestowed by grace or any other way. You know it directly. This kind of relates to that sutta I gave, the talk I gave a couple weeks ago on Sada, the question of faith. You don't take anything on faith in the Buddhist teachings. You develop it directly. You have the ongoing experience of developing the path. We've all talked about that. We've recognized how we're less reactive and our minds are more at peace and we're seeing things in a different way. And when you finally let go of all self-referential views rooted in ignorance, you know it. You know that you're released. Released from what? Released from ignorance. But that's it. If you're released from ignorance, you're no longer living your life making decisions and making further assumptions rooted in ignorance. You see things clearly. No matter what occurs in the world at that point, you remain calm and at peace, and you feel and think what's appropriate when it's appropriate to think and feel that way. In the Vitakasanthana Sutta, the Buddha states, you gain the ability to think what you want to think when you want to think it. Isn't that wonderful? A great place to be. So that's the end of the talk today. Any questions on the talk, and then we'll go around the room. No, we're good. Matt, good to see you.
Good to see you, John. Good to see everybody here. I just sort of reiterate that whether it's chocolate cake or ice cream or whatever it is, do you really need to have another piece or another bowl or another scoop to know that the enjoyment that you're getting from it doesn't last longer than the last bite or the last spoonful? Or so to maintain the condition that more ice cream or more cake or more whatever is going to keep the happiness going, you're ignoring the impermanence of the cake, the ice cream, whatever.
The taste.
So we do that in a lot of different ways in our lives, not just through the sense gate of taste. We do it through belief and what we tell ourselves about what we think and what we tell ourselves about what we hear. And those conditions are maintained through ignoring the three marks of existence.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you. Kevin, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you, John. I'll indulge you since it's your birthday. There's a funny, rather than chocolate cake, send it to Matt, maybe a life event, and this is a funny event. All this conditioned sort of thing that I've built up over many, many years is playing this game of golf. There's this course called Pine Valley, which is supposedly the greatest course in the world. Yeah. I've been fortunate to play this course. And if you think about it, for 20 years I wanted to play this course. Went and played this place. And people would ask me, you know, because they're asking from a different view, what's that like? What's that like? And well, you said, I experienced it. I went there, I played it, and I got up the next day and ate my breakfast and went to work. And it was great. It was green and it was beautiful. And I'm pretty lucky to say I played it, but that's not what was making me happy, you know. And yeah. You look back and you say, wow, did I really, was I awake or was I? I was pretty darn awake because it was pretty fun and I pretty remember it really vividly, but then I let it go. So it's just an interesting little nugget I had to.
Yeah.
So thank you for teaching this. And you know, at the time you're doing it with the retreat coming up, I think it's great to dive back into this teaching because it's so essential.
Thank you. Rob, good to see you.
I realize that sitting here and hearing the conversation, anytime you catch yourself thinking, this is going to make me happy, like large alarm bells should go off. No, it is not. Because just by itself, it's like, this is not even possible. Nothing is going to make you happy.
Yep.
No event, no person, no, nothing is going to make you happy. It's an impossibility.
It is.
It's a matter of catching yourself, you know, thinking that way. Yeah, that would be good. No.
Yeah.
Wrong view.
That is such a good example of it. But we think that we found something that makes us happy, whether it's chocolate cake or something else, you know, a certain TV show, certain music, certain book, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. As long as we can keep the conditions that will allow us to have those things, then we'll be able to be happy. And we feel like that's the way to control our lives. Mm-hmm. When you think about where the Buddha came from, this incredible life of luxury. And he knew if he was going to develop happiness for himself, he had to get out of that. He described his life in the palace as a confining place.
Because he saw that everything was there that should have made him happy. And he was challenging enough to see that he wasn't happy.
Yep, and when he left the palace grounds the first time, and then he saw the suffering in the world, the true suffering. He saw sickness, aging, and death for the first time. He saw the competitiveness in the town, between the competitiveness between people, and the struggle just to stay alive and to maintain what they thought they needed to be happy. That so shocked him that he said, I got to figure out what this is about. Is there a way to understand? Because he had lived the extreme view, or the extreme life of great wealth, and he's now seen that other extreme view of that, the suffering in the world. He had to figure it out. Thank you. Maura, good to see you.
Good to be here. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Oh, you get to clap him. Happy birthday. I'm just going to keep it brief. I go back. I was just looking. I can't see that board from here, but I think I see where it is.
It from here.
I think about that, not the last retreat, but the retreat before that, because that was kind of when you did all this, and you were reading those, it might have been the Natalakana Sutta, I don't know, but when the Buddha teaches that whole thing of, if these five clinging aggregates are impermanent, right, we've agreed that, then if they're impermanent, they must result in dukkha, so therefore, because they can't be self, they can't be anything but. They just can't be. And it's just that simple.
It is that simple.
That's all it is. Like, and that really helps me, helps this unfolding, emergent process that sometimes thinks this is me. It really helps to just cut it, you know.
Yeah.
Down to that. But it, anything that comes from there is not me. It is impermanent. It can only result in dukkha, suffering, dissatisfaction, crankiness, lack of flow, stopping up the fountain, lack of flourishing. I can do a lot of synonyms.
You don't want to use disenchanted, do you? So yeah, in that sutta, right. The Buddha says if it's impermanent, it cannot be a self. When I think of it, I mean, how can it be?
Yeah, so...
how can you claim a permanence?
It can only be suffering. Right?
Yeah.
So our dissatisfaction, it can only be... but we think, because of confusion, that, that's all the good stuff. So as soon as one recognizes, catches that process, I think in anywhere, in any of those steps and links of the chain and all that, it's very hard. I would say, to cognize about this, we're not awakened, so we can see the process. And thank you, because you through the repetition and the use of the very skillful use of the suttas, it's clear to understand that. But the actual unfolding of it, sometimes we're already caught in a mental formation when we're thinking about this whole process. So I think, just reeling it back, watching when that big CD is scooped onto the plate, and following that thought for the entire day. I have to get some of it.
Maura had an unpleasant experience with baked CD a couple of weeks ago.
But I thought it was going to make me happy.
You did all day, you thought.
Yeah, there you go.
Anyway, so yeah, that's it. Happy birthday.
Thank you. Yeah, the simple explanation of dependent origination, and it is simple, is so hard to grasp. And it is because of where it begins, in ignorance. That it is such, I see this more and more, unfortunately. To pierce that veil of ignorance is really the difficult thing. Because we've created such intricate strategies in our own minds to ignore anything that would challenge that ignorance. Including developing so-called spiritual practices that only continue that ignorance. And again, not putting any of those things down. But that's the great... it's the great impetus behind the world. It provides this great, opaque, but continuous view of ignorance that we can't see through. Except when we look at how the Buddha's simple description of the birth of suffering. Rooted in ignorance, gives birth, sickness, aging, death, regret, sorrow, lamentation, the whole mass of suffering, not getting what we want, getting what we don't want, being stuck in this personal experience of suffering known as five clinging aggregates. All rooted in ignorance. Matt.
Just briefly, you had even said it earlier, in that ignorance is the requisite condition. We create these conditions to control, to have control in our life, to have control of life. So automatically, we can't get anything else but suffering, because, or at least dukkha, because the conditions are rooted in ignorance of the three marks of existence. So
yep.
we're trying to control our lives through conditioned thinking. So the futility is just mm-hmm. epic.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. You're trying to control something that you have no idea what it is.
Right. It's insidious.
In an environment that you're not willing to concede is impermanent.
Exactly.
How can it not? Another word for dukkha is stress. How can it not create stress?
Right.
And it's taken us 2,600 years for the medical profession to finally realize that the biggest cause for dis-ease in the world is stress.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And the biggest cause of stress, as the Buddha declared 2,600 years ago, is not having a physical body. It's wrong views. It's the way we think. The hardest thing to change is wrong views. The hardest thing to change is ignorance.
Yeah.
Why? Because we've, again, I'll say it again, we've created these incredibly intricate scenarios, strategies, to continue ignorance, to ignore what's right in front of us. That's awakening. But you think about the, we're able to have a context to look at this. Siddhartha Gautama kind of plucked it out of thin air, but careful observation. And he also, remember in the Nagara Sutta, he went through a process of recognizing what it wasn't, meaning all the different spiritual teachings at his time, and then looking at the common human condition. And then he had this great aha moment rooted in concentration. It's ignorance. And it's a very specific ignorance. And so his very first teaching was the teaching on Four Noble Truths. That laid the context and the foundation for everything else he would teach. The Four Noble Truths bring wisdom where there was once ignorance. And specifically, it's the Eightfold Path that is a framework. So you talk about using the word ignorance. Another word for ignorance would be deluded thinking. How do you know when you're deluded? How would you if you're deluded? Everything you're doing is to reinforce that delusion. Unless you have a framework for recognizing where that delusion is manifesting. That's the Eightfold Path. It's the only reason he taught that. Mike, good to see you.
Good to see you too. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Sorry I was a couple minutes late.
I'm glad you made it.
Well, there's a sign up the road, spray painted, that says tacos and pierogies. It's outside. I think it's a Masonic building out there.
And really? Let's go.
I went down about 5 miles an hour from there to here, trying to decide if I was going to go back there or here. Who would have said chocolate cake on the bottom? You would not have seen it tonight. But,
I saw that sign too.
I was like, wow.
It does sound good, doesn't it?
I've always been a big fan of street food, working in New York and everything, so, you know, advertisements never. Spray paint? Yeah, sure.
We know that that's good.
Yeah. I something just popped into my head earlier, and so I have a form of, I guess you can call it, selective OCD. There's some things that I'm just very obsessive-compulsive about, and others that I'm not at all. So I guess you can't really put it in a box, but I have a responsibility at the end of my work day where I basically have to check like 5 or 6 things that are pretty simple to check and send an email saying, you know, everything is good to go. Mm-hmm. You could train a third grader to do this without any problem. But if I were to get it wrong, there would potentially be legal, regulatory, big problems. My job could be in jeopardy if it happened more than once or twice. So there's a load of pressure, even though it's very something very simple.
Yeah.
There's a load of pressure underneath. And so I will check this over and over 5, 10, 15 times, even though it's right there in simple form before sending that email. And I was just thinking as you were talking, am I clinging to not being wrong, not being in trouble, not getting reprimanded, not getting fired? Because once I send that email, if I made a mistake, then I've got all these consequences. Until then, as long as I'm prolonging it by, you know, keep checking over and over, I'm not in any trouble. This is my chocolate cake.
Well, what I would say in general, you've developed a conditioned response to the end of work routine, and that's what you do. That's what you're familiar with it. If you think you want to undo it, I would first start with being very gentle with yourself about doing it. You know, and then try to stop the reiterations of the same action.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but and learn to become at peace with it. You've done your job. But that's all. It's just a conditioned response. We also have to look at what is the ramifications of a certain behavior. It doesn't sound like it's creating a lot of suffering in your life. So again, going back to being gentle with it, if you recognize it as something that you'd like to change, apply restraint. When you notice that you're caught up in the thought again, I hope I did it right.
Mm-hmm.
Much like the thought, did I turn the gas off when I left? You know,
right.
It's at that point that you can. It's only at that point that you could practice restraint, saying, "Okay, I did what I want. I did what I needed to do. Come back into the present moment and get on with the next moment in your life." And the more you do that, the more you'll decondition that response that keeps you going in it. So I hope that helped.
No, it did. I wish I had a chocolate cake equivalent that was positive, that was something that I liked. In my case, it's like, I guess...
Yeah. So take, do your best to take satisfaction in a job well done. You know, because that you've done it. You know,
people make mistakes.
Yeah,
too. That's the other thing. You know, I have my own business, and I know what you're going through. Because I do stuff. I have a list that I check off. You know what? If I miss one of those things at the end of the day, I'm human.
Yeah, it's hard though. When I had my own construction business, I spent nights laying around in bed hoping, you know, did the guys do this? Did they do that? Did they nail the tarp down right? It's raining, you know, all those things. So, and again, the only thing you can do is to be I'll say it another way. Don't judge yourself harshly, but if it's something that you'd like to change, the best way to change anything is practice restraint at the point of occurrence. And just say, this is what I'm doing. You can use your breath, come back to the sensation of breathing, and then move into the next moment of your life. And you'll slowly start disentangling the pattern thinking or the conditioned thinking. You know, and it really does work that directly and that nicely, too. So thank you for bringing it up. Tim, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good, thank you. Good to be back.
Good to see you. How was your trip?
It was good. It was a couple things I was thinking about during the trip that ties into what we're talking about today and about things that make you happy. One of the things that I've been grasping that topic was when I'm doing something is the quality of the thing I'm doing. Okay, if so many people want to go to that golf course because it's a good golf course, or they want to go to that beach because it's supposedly a good beach. But what about going there because it's really awesome? And when you're there, instead of saying, wow, I'm here, and just take it in. This is a quality event in my life. This is a quality time. And I'm going to live in this moment and enjoy this thing. And it could be something that's looking at the stars. It could be golfing the golf course. It could be reading a really good book. And get lost in that moment. Yep. And I've been kind of grappling with those concepts quite a bit, and with everything in my life, even things at work, and trying to attach a sense of quality. And I'm trying to avoid things that distract me or make me kind of ruin my tranquility that aren't quality. If there's events in my life that I'm doing that are not a quality thing, or they make me upset, or not make me upset, but upset the quality of that moment. Mm-hmm. I try to get away from it. And I don't know if that's maybe just kind of, you know, shirking responsibility, because sometimes we do have to obviously do things that are uncomfortable. But even in those things, I think that you can grab a moment of quality, even if it's something that could be a sad thing. You can still grab something out of that moment. And so that's something when reading your book and meditating, I've been grappling with a lot, that idea. And that this talk kind of helped me a little bit. I won't lie. I mean, there's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of uncertainty. And every time I come here,
it's layers.
But that's something that I hear from everybody. And it's something that I think is important. And maybe you can shine a little light on that for me.
I hope so.
Okay.
So, again, just by your question, I can see that you're gaining a good understanding of the implications of what this is about. And so it may seem like I'm not supposed to enjoy anything. I'm not supposed to take true pleasure in the things of the world. That's often a beginning view, because it seems like annihilation. What's going to happen when I don't attach myself to things, when I don't create or describe my life by the events of my life? What happens as we start developing right view, letting go of assumptions rooted in ignorance about how things should be, then no matter what's occurring is meaningful. And so whatever it is, whether it's a beautiful beach or a great golf course or an awful event, it's meaningful because we're present for it. It's part of our lives. And because we don't need our lives to be any different, no matter what's occurring is significant because we're now a part of it. We can be with it fully. We can feel what's ever appropriate. But we also don't lose sight of what's occurring now because of what might occur. In other words, I'm going to going to Hawaii next week. And if I get compulsive about that, all I can think about is being in Hawaii. And no matter what's occurring right now is not going to measure up to it. I won't enjoy my life right in this present moment. But rather than make my plan and buy my ticket and take care of my hotel room and then kind of forget about it, you know?
I told my wife, I'm like, I don't, at my point in my life now, I don't need all that. I can be happy just in my garden.
Yeah.
And I mean that. And it, for whatever reason, you know, and so many things that I have to do is for my family. They want to do those things and I want to be with my family. But for me, I don't need those things. However, that doesn't mean I can't still enjoy that time.
It doesn't mean that at all.
You know, and I said something kind of, we were talking with my wife, and I said something that was profound. My mother-in-law lost her best friend. And, you know, we were talking, and I said, you know, I know this is going to sound, you know, kind of cold, but, you know, I feel that we learn the most when something happens that affects us in a, we think, a bad way at that time. We gain so much perspective, and I want to embrace those things rather than try to avoid them. You know, just if they're going to happen, they're going to happen. You know, can't, the world is constantly growing.
Yeah.
But this talk kind of touched it. It had a lot of layers to it.
It does. It's a good way of looking at it. Dukkha describes the worldly causes and conditions. There's going to be things that are disappointing. There's going to be great tragedies. And knowing that there's nothing we can do about it except be present for it and for the people in our lives brings a mind of peace and calm. Again, because we don't want things to be different. And most people, as they develop the Dhamma, their lives simply become simpler. And that's just because you don't have this inner drive to always be doing something, you know, always be going somewhere. But that's a natural occurrence. It's not, you can't, one of the problems that we often fall into, and it's often seen, is creating the outward appearance of like a disconnection. I'm not clinging to anything as a way of showing maybe yourself, but showing the world, rather than actually have the experience. So this sutta points to that. Directly. It's not so much what's going on outside of ourselves or to the physical body. What's going on between our ears? What's our thinking like? What is the quality of our thinking like? Is that quality well-framed? Is it rooted in concentration and well-framed by the Eightfold Path? Because then all the other things take care of themselves. You know, and you'll, whether you're having great events or not, really won't matter. And if you do have big events, it's because what's going on in your life. That's all.
And it's good to have a healthy suspicion of things that are promised to you to make you happy.
Yeah.
Because they're unlikely to.
Well, again, I don't... The word happy, you know, I have a problem with that word.
Yeah.
You know? I prefer tranquility. I don't know if that makes any sense. Because happiness is kind of like...
The Buddha wrote a great, or maybe there's some controversy about the Book of Eights, that very early book, that is really just about the simplicity and contentment and really looking like what you said about, is this mind state creating disruption or peace? And one thing that I would say also about, you know, sitting in the garden not having to do things. Now, I was actually recently traveling, and it was too much. And, you know, I don't ever feel this... Well, John might disagree, but I don't feel this great need. Like, seeing one thing is enough, right? Otherwise, you lose your ability to kind of be there. Well, you don't really lose it. But it seems a bit overwhelming because we can only process so much and kind of take in things. And so this need to accumulate experiences, it begins to leave because everything is poignant in and of itself. The sadness is poignant, you know. We recognize,
I think that, you know, life is very precious. It's very unpredictable, and therefore, how do you want to spend it? What do you want to do with it? Sorry.
Thank you.
I wasn't going to talk much.
Thank you, Kate. Helen, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Thank you, John. Good to be here. Good to be with all of you. I look forward to this every week.
I do, too.
So, a couple of different thoughts. One is that being truly mindfully present really is the greatest gift you can give yourself or others.
Yep.
And that it's okay to be happy, and I'm okay with happy, and I love tranquility too, and joyfulness, and all of that. It kind of runs through our family. We all have a lot of interests, and the more things that you are interested in, actually, the more opportunities you have to be happy or intrigued or tranquil or peaceful. So I embrace all of that, but I understand that it's embrace in the sense of loving that moment, but not being disappointed when there's a different moment that comes. Then there's something else there. So that's, you know, when we're talking, sometimes it sounds like we're saying, you know, don't get your hopes up, you're not going to be happy. You know, and that's really not what we're saying. It's just, you know, in a sense, sort of temper your passion. There's something else is going to come, and be ready and be mindful of what that is and be present, because that really is the greatest gift. Then the other thing you mentioned about dis-ease and stress, I started thinking about how we are all distracted, and we're expressions for distraction sometimes are my mind was somewhere else. I was thinking somewhere else. And it really is sort of like your mind and your body are not connected anymore. And that's that dissonance is what I think we all struggle with. That's that thing that keeps us from being present and mindful and truly there.
Being whole.
Right, and not being whole. And so what Lorna said on Saturday, I believe, about when you're meditating and when you're coming back to your breath, share your breath with that moment. I thought that was so beautiful and so poignant. It's a lovely, proactive way to be present. And I thought that was so lovely. So those are some of the things that I've been working on and kind of came to me today, too.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, life is incredible. And it's even better when we're not attached to it. So you have all those great experiences. That's just it. That's just part of life. And every now and then there's a clunker in there. So what? Take a breath, move on. Thank you. Mary, good to see you.
Oh, good to be here. Thank you. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
I was thinking, Mike, that there are about 250 work days in the year. So if you've been employed in this job for at least a year, you've done it 249 times, right? Whatever that closeout you have to do. And one of the things that I remember one of the first times I took John's advice of, you know, be gentle with yourself and don't forget, like, you're starting to see things correctly when you can recognize the good things, right? So recognize that you did it right without consequence, and you must have done it right without consequence.
As far as I know, I always have, yeah. It's the fear of the getting it
right.
Wrong,
but
fear of feeling stupid, that how could I get something so easy wrong?
Right.
Do you see the conditioned response in that, though, Mike?
Oh, absolutely,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's important. That's the important part of it, too.
Right, and we all have that. It's just sometimes we have to flip the coin and say, you know what, this is actually something I'm really good at. Because 249 times every year, I've done it absolutely correctly without any negative consequence. And not to get, like, I like the word disenchanted, because you don't want to get over the top with that. Wow, I'm so good at this. That's when it's going to, you know, fall apart. But to be the middle way about it, as opposed to attached to the fear. I'm the same way. I'm often projecting myself into the future for the fear if I raised my children wrong or did this
what
wrong.
What will the headlines say?
Oh, what the headlines say, right? I remember I went to Italy after 9/11. Yuppie parents leave two children at home while they gallivant through Italy. That was my...
Did you really?
That was my headline. You know? Oh, my God. Anyway, not that I'm hanging on to that. 2 years later. Anyway, leave their kid with an Annie. Oh my God.
16.
However many years ago. And they're healthy, normal, and in college. So it's all good.
Yeah, you can let that one go now.
I mean, thank you. I think I will. Sometimes you have to say it out loud for you. Like, I know, my husband's listening and probably like rolling his eyeballs. Anyway, I was thinking what you said, Ram, about nothing can bring you happiness. And I think one of the things about this that makes so much sense to me is because, again, you can flip that coin and nothing can make you unhappy. Mm-hmm. And that's really powerful mm-hmm. to me. You know, I've been struggling with something over the last couple of weeks and, you know, using analogies like my knife isn't sharp, my lenses are muddy or whatever. And it's only through concentration that you can sharpen your knife or clean your lenses or whatever to give you right view and to release the things you need to release from clinging and craving. And so going back to disenchantment, to get disenchanted, it's kind of like the first time I heard you use the word dispassionate. And I was like, dispassionate? I'm a passionate person. I thrive on that. I love that dispassion. I had to look it up. I had to really process it. So disenchantment has the same impact. Like, oh, what does that mean? I can be disenchanted with what's making me unhappy too. You know, or at least that's working for me. The idea that you might be holding on to something that you're giving a lot of energy to, that's making you unhappy about whatever you've heard or whatever's going on, right? But to get disenchanted by it is to make it absolutely powerless.
Yeah.
Doesn't have power over you.
That's the problem of enchantment is just that. We're enchanted with ourselves.
Well, and then
that's the essence of conceit. And in relation to the world, we become enamored with this whole process that Matt pointed out is there's nothing there. It's not like, you know, it's not like we made some mistakes. Nothing happened, except that we believe that we've done something. But what we've done is completely insubstantial. It's anatta. There's nothing there, except we're living a life that is flowing from wrong views, and so it all seems real.
Well,
it seems significant.
Wrong view for me are things like continuity, like what we talked about. What feels like only recently to me, we've probably been talking about it for 2 years, but the whole idea of continuity obscures impermanence.
Yep.
So, for example, there are so many things in a work environment, or I am in a corporate work environment, that are just like standards, right?
Mm.
They're not, they go against things we're talking about here, you know? So, professional reputation. Like, what is that? You know, like that's a currency or something, right? But what does that even mean? That's impermanent. That's an example of something that can look like continuity. You built a career over this amount of time, you know, doing this, you know, whatever. But it's obscuring impermanence. And by doing that, anything that could affect that professional reputation in my situation feels like it could be threatening. And it's hard to let go, or it feels like it could be all sorts of negative things, right? But it's nothing. It's absolutely nothing.
Yeah. But it creates an underlying tension or stress, doesn't it?
Yeah. And to become disenchanted with that thing that you're holding on to, whether it's the the word like reputation being that continuity, or the hanging on to the, a negative feeling in that scenario, by getting disenchanted with all of that, allows a lot of that negativity to flow away from me.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And you develop that disenchantment by the framework of the Eightfold Path, because
absolutely,
it allows you to see things clearly. It also allows you, as you're even in a professional application of your job, if you're living within the framework of the Eightfold Path, you're doing everything you
exactly
can in a professional way also.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so what else can you do?
Right.
You learn to let go of those
right
of those fears and those stressors that
right
are just out there
mm-hmm
and have no basis in reality, because you're doing everything you can.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You're
mm-hmm
seeing things clearly. You have the intention to maintain a lack of craving and clinging in each situation. Your behavior is framed by right speech, right action, and right livelihood. You're engaged in right effort, and you're putting some time in to remain mindful and well concentrated. What else can you do?
Right.
You know? And very likely you're going to, in whatever field you're in, you're going to excel because you're free of ignorance.
Well, it's a lot easier to be consistent.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Margaret, welcome to our Sangha. How how was your meditation, and what do you think about this crazy talk tonight?
My meditation was great.
Good.
So thank you for that.
Glad you're here.
When you were talking about the sunsets in Hawaii, I just had this feeling. I had a wonderful vacation this summer in Scotland, which was magical and beautiful. And my husband and I talk a lot about that. Like, oh, wait, let's go back, right? Like, we talk about, let's go back again. And I keep, my reaction is, well, wouldn't that be wonderful? But we can't go back. I mean, you could go back to that place, those same places,
yeah,
but we can never go back to that moment or those exact conditions, the feelings that we had there. And that's okay. So just being okay with that,
yeah,
impermanence, and just knowing that, well, there will be other
mm-hmm
Scotlands and moments that will be just as fulfilling.
Yeah. Thank you. And you recognize how fortunate you were to have the experience. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? If it wasn't so late, I'd tell you about the green flash in Hawaii, but some other time. Wait a minute. No, I won't. As far as your meditation, you were able to maintain the method. You recognized when you were caught up in your thoughts and you came back to your breathing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the basic practice. If you continue with that, and at home, if you're going to, start with 2 or 3 or 4 minutes, and if you can do that consistently twice a day, very quickly you'll have an established meditation practice. And then if you can be part of our Sangha, I hope you continue to join us. You'll learn more about the things that we've talked about tonight in the broader application of the Eightfold Path. So it's not just meditation. On my website, becoming-buddha.com, there's a recording of this meditation that you can download and listen to and help guide you. And there's a bunch of information in relation to this. A good place to start there is on the top menu is a page for new visitors, and that'll direct you towards other things. But I'm glad you joined us tonight, and I hope you do again.
Can you put the air conditioning on?
You just told
maybe
me to turn it off.
Can I open a window?
I'm just kidding. It is. It's getting a little. Oh, wait, it was on. This wasn't high enough. Antonio, how are you? Good to see you tonight.
See you. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
God bless you. God bless everyone here.
Thank you.
I'm still like new with all this. I don't know. Where do I start? What am I supposed to say?
Whatever you're comfortable with, then you don't have to say anything. I don't want to put any pressure on you. I'm glad you're here.
I'm just like new to all the, yeah, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Really, just glad you joined us again.
Yeah, thank you so much for, I'm sorry to come in while you got, drove over here.
Glad you're here. Glad you're here tonight. Vicki, how are you? It's good to see you.
How are you? You missed the dog.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Charlotte.
Charlotte.
She's out now.
It's working.
Was that Ram? Is that your technique? Did you explain the Dharma to that dog?
Charlotte gets it.
Dog's Dharma. He was just
trying to stop thinking about dog biscuits and I just quit. Not going to wake me up.
Thank you so much for having me. Have her here.
we're having her be comfortable. I was going to leave her downstairs, and then I was going to leave her in there, but Mara said she can come in.
Not the first dog.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm sitting here struggling a bit. Listening to your talk, and I don't know like how much I'm perpetuating my own suffering. So clearly that relationship is done over where it was very abusive. Cycle of abuse and rage that, you know, I explained a bit. I think Matthew, during an acupuncture session, said, because, you know, sometimes I feel shame for my part in it, which I was today, and which Matthew said was very normal, and I guess it is normal in order for me to heal from it. You know, I certainly have to be accountable for my part in it and for perpetuating it. But, and again, this is where I don't know if I'm grounded in ignorance or what, and I'm trying to detach from it. But, you know, I feel like I was slandered by this person to, like, a large community. And I come in contact with these people, different various people a lot, where I feel that. And that happened today. And I tried, you know, as I'm feeling it, I'm standing there trying to be proud and strong, and I'm trying not to feel it, but like I acknowledge it, that I see it. But then it really hurts me and affects me afterwards, and it like ruined my day. I'm sitting here. I'm feeling a lot. So then a friend of mine wrote, you know, I do photography and post a lot of pictures, and a friend, you know, I get a lot of beautiful, wonderful comments on Facebook and Instagram, and this one woman said to me, because I posted a picture where I was, like, making friends, we were down the shore the other day, and I can talk easily and freely, and thank you so much, and make friends quickly, and so my friend acknowledged that, you know, because I posted a picture of these new people we just met on the boardwalk that, you know, felt like friends, and I'm like, my gosh, if only this one person, like, saw that view of me instead of, like, this monster or this non-human monster that he makes me feel like, you know? And so anyway, I'm struggling with what I perceive to be views of me and what I feel, trying not to, anyway, I've just noticed perhaps I'm perpetuating my suffering in this, even though the relationship is dissolved. But somehow, you know, I realize it will take some time, a lot of damage. But so I'm struggling with that, and I don't know if I'm rooted in ignorance by feeling all this, you know? Because one time I did confront someone who I would have sworn he told things to me about, and she had no idea, you know? She didn't know any of it, so I didn't even go into it, but... So I don't know how much is my, what's the word? I don't know, you know, misguided thinking, but I'm struggling. So, you know, I come, I get what I can, and I certainly feel peaceful here and comfortable enough that these feelings arise, you know? Anyway, thank you all for being here and for listening.
Can you come on a second?
Thank you for being here, Vicki. And for
we're talking about karma.
Yeah, I heard that.
And it's it might be just what you need to feel.
Yeah. I will try. I also wanted to mention the 21st of this month, I'm going to Cuba for a short trip, but then I'm going to be enrolling in school Tuesday, Thursday evenings, so I won't be able to come anymore. I will try to come Saturday. Although I'm also looking for part-time work, so I don't know what my schedule will be, but I certainly want to try to continue this, you know?
Yeah. I hope you do. I wouldn't concern yourself too much with are your actions rooted in ignorance or not. That's really not... That's not even the right way to apply dependent origination. To understand those teachings is just to recognize that the suffering that we all experience in our life and our reaction to that is rooted in ignorance, and that's really the only useful application of that. And that points directly to Four Noble Truths, which points to, as you can, you've only been here a couple of weeks, so it takes a little while. As you develop the Eightfold Path, kind of like what I said to Mary, that becomes the framework for how you interact with the world. And if your behavior is well framed by that, then you know that you're not causing any harm for other people. How other people react to you is really none of your business. There's nothing you can, and I mean that because there's really nothing you can do about it. As incredibly wonderful as I am, there's a lot of people that don't like me too. And that's just the way it is. So when we lose that, trying to see ourselves the way other people see us, think about what a feedback loop that is and how it really gets us confused and agitated. Stay within yourself. Be very, I say it almost every class, be very gentle with yourself. Don't try to analyze yourself too much and what you're doing. And if you continue to develop this meditation in the Eightfold Path, you're going to develop a calm and peaceful mind no matter what's occurring and what other people are doing or saying about you. It does sound like you got out of a hurtful relationship, and that's a fortunate thing, you know. And there's always a long period of time of just undoing all those emotions, and the best way to do that is just to go through it. You'll hear me say, if you continue to come, I hope you do, to be at peace with a less than peaceful mind state. That might sound crazy right now, but that really is kind of the essence of the Dhamma, because unpeaceful mind states will arise. But as long as we can let them be as they are, not need them to be any different. Another way of saying is not needing myself to be any different while I have those unpeaceful mind states, we can move through them much quicker. Mm-hmm. So be gentle with yourself. I'm glad you're here. And I hope you can join us on Saturday.
Thank you.
Lorna, good to see you.
Good to be here. Thank you. It seems every time we revisit Brendan's origination, I get something out of it. You look into it a bit deeper, a bit deeper, and get something out of it. But just to recap on what you said last week, the stories in your thinking obscure the passing away, meaning it's your thinking that's wishing you to hold on to something so that anatta is established. And that's the story, and I can really identify with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you, and that's the obscuring the passing away. Your mind wants to stay on the arising, and the thinking goes up to the arising, and you miss the passing away.
Yeah.
That was just like, you know, a great pickup for me last week. And then reading down Dependent Origination again, if I'm right, the end line of Dependent Origination, which refers to the suffering, the dukkha, is the whole mass of suffering is dependent on me wishing life is different than it is.
Yeah. And another way of saying that last part is continuing to ignore ignorance, is wishing life was different than it is. Just another way.
I can identify to my thinking when I am wishing life is different than it is.
Yeah.
I can identify to that.
Yeah.
So I can loop that back into all the suffering.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And for me, wishing life to be different than it is dependent on craving and clinging.
Yep.
So that's where the whole ball of wax starts.
The whole mass of suffering.
Yeah. So I just see that this time, as I say, you learn a little bit more on dependent origination each time you revisit it, and I can see that from the whole mass of suffering, how I got there. I'm beginning to see how I got there, how you really get there.
Yeah.
So you're thinking, wishing life to be different, and the craving and clinging, which is following, as I say, I'm beginning to see the steps, really see the steps a little bit more clearly.
Yeah, and it's all tied together. Wanting life to be different is craving, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
And that that story of our life that we are always telling ourselves is the story of craving and clinging. Look at that story closely, and it's what we want to get, what we want to have, what we want to avoid, what we're holding on to. It's the same boring story if we look at it. And so we become, sorry to use the word again, we become, as we look at it, if we don't look at it, disenchantment can arise. How could it? Unless we're looking at it, unless we're applying things correctly. But when we start looking at it clearly, we realize the futility. We realize what Kundana realized. All conditioned things are subject to cessation. What Lao Tzu said, you recognize the impermanence of all things, you'll let go of everything. Why keep doing this? Why keep stuck in Groundhog Day when you recognize that's all it is? Thank you.
Can we just back up just to right before? Because like as an example, when emotions arise, so what you just said, Lorna too, like the wanting life to be different and wanting situations to be different. So sadness arises if somebody in a situation socially hurt, you know, somebody is saying, Maura, you just screwed up and, you know, we don't want you here anymore and this job, like, and the natural reaction is going to be like, ooh, I don't know if I can, you know, so recognizing that, not wanting my reaction to be different, allowing that closing to open in the body, heart, you know, and that takes so much time to develop a sense of softness and kindness that gives some space for those, our body, to me, has the amazing ability to allow us to experience what we're capable of handling at any given moment, right? So our shutting down processes initially is because it's just too much. You know, so we have to build tenderness and kindness and mindfulness and just trust in that process that it will eventually allow us to really experience what we're experiencing. And when we can't, that's okay too. Like, it's enough right now to just know that I'm going towards being able to let emotions flow through, and maybe that wasn't a safe space for you to allow that feeling right now. So here you are, like you said, and you can feel those emotions coming up and let them flow. And so it's kind of not even wanting that to be different. I close, okay. I'm open, okay. Somebody said something, I don't like it, I don't want it to be different, okay. But I'm going to let go of all that. I'm going to just continue to realize that my freedom comes in the direction of allowing people and events to just flow. And there's great freedom in that, because then they'll flow instead of getting stuck and rehashing. But right now, like for me, when I get caught, I see myself in a ruminative pattern, I know that's the best I can do right now. Like, it's okay. I'm not enlightened. I'm not fully become the Buddha. I'm trying, you know, and there are moments, but like to just to really be kind around whatever is emerging right now. It's kind of the best I've got.
I did want to thank you so much. I did want to reiterate that, you know, as soon as I settled in, like, these feelings came up, and I knew it was because this was a safe place.
Yeah.
And I said, but, you know, shit, like, I don't want to do this. You know what I mean? But I did feel safe that's why they did arise. And thank you for acknowledging that. And I wanted you to know that, and everyone to know that as well, you know?
Well, we're all glad you feel safe here, too. So that's important.
Thank you.
Thank you, Becky. Thank you, Lorna. Liz, good to see you.
Happy birthday, John.
Thank you.
So when you first start on this road and through this process, there's a fear, and you sort of say to yourself, oh my God, nothing is the way I think it is or that I've lived by. And then you come for, you know, I'm here almost, I think, 2.5 years, maybe 4 or 5. time. But so you then once things start to make sense, you say, "Thank God things aren't the way I
thought." And it's like, I'm happy to be
wrong. Yeah. So that's all I have.
Thank you. That's great. Bonnie, good to see you.
Nice to see you. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
I have nothing to add. Everything has been pretty much set.
Thank you. Thank you all. I think I've said enough tonight, too. So we'll finish, as we always do, with the Karaniya Metta Sutta. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. Metta means goodwill or loving kindness. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.